It's time to talk aviation.
This is XTP Media.
It was windy, it was rainy, and there was a thunderstorm sitting near the airfield, and we had to get on the ground, and as did everybody else. That was one of those approaches, and it was in the Q400, so no auto throttle, working quite hard, where I was exhausted by the time I got on the ground.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 113 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by Ellie Carter, and Ellie is, of course, a private pilot and a STEM ambassador. Ellie, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for putting up with me again.
No, we're delighted to have you back and supporting me on this, particularly on this interview. But before we get to our guest, you deserve some congratulations on a recent award, the Breitling Award. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you so much. So the Royal Aero Club decided to give me the President Breitling's Award for my work to promote other young people into aviation, which is a real honour, actually, to be seen so highly by those people.
It's awesome. Well, congratulations from all of us here and from everyone associated with the programme. Well done.
Thank you.
And our guest today is Katie Lee. Katie's an airline pilot with a major European airline with a special interest in human factors. Katie's also involved with the Royal Air Force Air Cadets and is a trustee for the charity Pilots Together. Katie, welcome to Extended.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Been feverishly watching your social media activity. Before we get on to the detail of learning a bit more about you and some of the great work you do, how's life at the moment? Because obviously the industry you're on has been so heavily affected by recent events. What sort of impact's that having on you?
I think it's significant for everyone that works in aviation. My roster is more or less blank at the moment, so I'm glad I've got things like the Air Cadets and Pilots Together to sort of keep me busy. But I think for all of us in aviation, it's a bit of a waiting game for the next few months to get people back in the skies, to get ourselves back in the skies and do what we love best, really.
Right, okay. Well, our fingers are crossed. And we're going to talk about the work that Pilots Together in particular does to support the sector at the moment. But let's go back to the beginning. Where did this all start for you?
So I started flying when I was 15, I think. Decided to do a PPL. My father had been a pilot, and it seemed like it was worth finding out what it was that he loved about aviation. Now, ironically, I since found out that he didn't like general aviation whatsoever.
Okay. Right.
But never mind, though. I think for him it was a means to an end. He loved working for the airlines, but nothing smaller. But I started flying at 15, got my PPL at 17, 18, went straight to flying school. And the rest, the rest is history, really.
Tell us a little bit about your PPL. Whereabouts did you do that, and how did you feel going into a sector that was predominantly male oriented? What were the challenges like for you?
So I did my PPL at Wickham Airpark with British Airways Flying Club, as was
on
the A28.
Yeah.
They've since been renamed, But do you know, I don't really think I thought about the challenges of the sector when I was doing my PPL, because it really wasn't as obvious.
Right.
We had a disproportionate number of female flight instructors, and lots of female pilots used to fly out of the airfield, so you didn't really see it in the same way that you do in commercial aviation.
Yeah.
You know, that said, most of my flight instructors were men. They were generally much older men, which was, I'm not sure it was intimidating per se, but it was certainly a very different dynamic from what I was used to at the age of sort of 15, 16.
Right.
But no, I mean, I don't think I really noticed the disparity gender-wise
yeah.
as much until I got into the commercial sector, where it's very different.
Yeah, okay. And a question everyone wants to know is about going solo. What was it like to go solo? When was it? What sort of stage was it in your training?
So I went solo quite early. I think I had 10 hours or 11 hours. And it came as a complete surprise. My flight instructor at the time, who's still one of my best friends, hadn't pre-warned me. We'd got to the holding point after a couple of circuits and he got out. Said, all right, see you later.
Yeah.
And it took a couple of minutes for me to kind of go, what's going on here? What have I missed? And I think because I had no prior warning, I hadn't had time to get nervous. And it wasn't until I was on the downwind leg that I suddenly thought, okay, this is all up to me to get this back on the ground. And right this minute, I have no idea what I'm doing. I think most of us feel that way
yeah.
on our first solo.
Yeah.
But because I hadn't had any sort of prior warning, it wasn't as nerve-wracking as it could have been. I think the adrenaline hit me when I got back down, parked the aircraft, turned the engine off, and kind of went, oh, wow, okay. I was not expecting that, but it was...
Okay, and did you always have an intention that your objective was to go into the airlines, or did you have any other aspirations for coming into the sector?
No, do you know, I'd never really thought about it until I started my PPL. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I was considering an economics degree, toying with lots of ideas. It sort of harks back to the human factors stuff, really.
Yeah.
That I wanted to go into sort of international development. But I really got hooked by the PPL stuff and talking with some of the other guys and girls at the club about sort of their aspirations and what they were doing or what they had done. It really drew me in. And then, you know, a lot of our family friends were airline pilots, cabin crew, all sorts. So the industry wasn't a complete shock. It wasn't a complete surprise. The early mornings, the weird roster patterns, that was kind of what I'd grown up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just sort of fell into it.
Where did your, if you don't mind me asking, who did your father fly with, and what aircraft did he fly?
So he was initially Cambrian on the Viscount.
Wow.
It's been a while.
No, that's really cool.
It is. I mean, you know, I saw a Viscount cockpit in one of the aviation museums a few years back.
Yeah.
I just sort of looked at it and thought, how can anyone decipher anything from this? But he then moved to BA when Cambrian got taken over and ended up on the 7-3. 7-3 Classic, but
right.
The 7-3.
Wow. Okay. And is he still with us?
No, he's been dead a while now.
Oh, bless you. Oh, what an amazing father to have, the Viscount. What a great aircraft. Do you know what? They're Dart engines, aren't they? They were Darts.
Yes.
Absolutely unique sound. You could always hear the Viscount coming a mile off before you saw it. You could hear it and mm-hmm. identify it. How wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. So after the PPL, what happened next? Where did you go next?
So I went to an integrated flying school. I went to Oxford Aviation Training, I think it was at the time. It's gone through so many name changes.
Yeah.
On an integrated course. I think because all of my sort of friends and colleagues had gone to university, and I felt like I wanted to sort of recreate the same experience at flying school rather than doing it modular. With the benefit of hindsight, I would absolutely have gone back and done it modular rather than integrated these days.
Right.
But why is that,
Katie? Sorry, just to interrupt.
So things have changed massively, I think, in the last what's it been, 14 years since I did my training. It was expensive then, but it wasn't extortionate. The prices that are being charged now are through the roof, and the value that you get from an integrated course is very little more than a modular course, realistically. So I think from a value for money perspective, modular is the way forward. It allows people to work at the same time if they want to, or to do it in stages, offers that flexibility as well of where to go. And I do worry a little bit about what the integrated flight schools are pushing out now. They're pushing out, they're selling a dream that's not realistic as it stands.
Yeah, okay. No, okay, I understand. And I believe you spent a bit of time as a flight instructor as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so I'm I say a qualified flight instructor. I think I'm a very lapsed flight instructor at the moment. high up my to-do list this year is to get my FI rating back because I loved it.
Yeah.
Did a bit of instructing at one of the RAF flying clubs, which was awesome. So lots of very sensible, very driven individuals who were flying.
Yeah.
So I had none of the sort of the horror stories that a lot of FIs have. I mean, God knows I tried to kill my flight instructor when I was doing my PPL. No one has ever tried to kill me in a light aircraft.
Right. Well, not so intentionally, far. I would imagine.
Well, not at all so far. There's still time.
Yeah. At this time as well, am I right in understanding that you took a slight deviation in your career to be a teacher?
Yeah, it wasn't intentional.
Okay.
So I came out of flying school during the big economic recession, 2008-2009.
Yeah.
So it's got a huge number of parallels with people that are coming out now, I suspect, that there were no jobs. We had a couple of people go out to Indonesia to fly some fairly questionable aircraft around some fairly questionable airfields. But the overwhelming majority of us had no prospect of getting into aviation, not commercial aviation. And I ended up falling into maths teaching because apparently a background in maths and a flight instructor's rating is all you need. bizarre.
Okay.
But of course, it's like anything, isn't it? Once you've got the experience and you've been doing it for a while, that experience counts for more than anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, 6 years as a maths teacher, which was absolutely not intentional. To pay the bills and keep going, really.
Right. Wow. There you go, Ellie. I know you're doing, is it A-level maths and applied maths? I think.
Maths, further maths and physics, but further I don't maths, know how good I'd be teaching, but give it a go.
There you go. There's always a role for maths teachers. But Katie, did that, how did you take that experience into the next part of your career? Because you then went on to fly the Q400, didn't you, the Dash 8, which you have really fond memories of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite glad I'm not flying it these days, purely because it was a challenging aircraft to fly, but I loved having started my career on it. Having started on a turboprop was absolutely invaluable. The challenges that we faced being in the weather every day, the challenges that we faced with tech issues, so the Dash went tech a lot more than the 73 does, a lot more. Lots of short hops, so lots of sectors up and down, super busy, no auto throttle, flying with different people every day. It was a great challenge, and such an invaluable sort of start to a flying career. I really wouldn't have changed that for the world.
Okay. Now, you flew predominantly domestically, wasn't it, in the Q400. Did you do any international hopping at all then?
Yeah, so I was Southampton based for the last couple of years that I was flying the Dash, and we did lots of work flying out to France, Germany, the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Was also lucky enough to do a detachment based out in Latvia, doing some of the Scandinavian routes, which was quite cool. Challenges that you just don't get here, the level of icing. You know, flying over the sea and it's sheet ice, it's incredible. So yeah, we did get away from the UK a little bit.
And did you have to do any additional training or familiarisation flying out in Scandinavia? You know, given those conditions, was there anything special, or was it a case of take your experience and do the best you could?
Yeah, there was nothing. So part of the recurrent training that we did included cold weather ops. But from there, it was, go ahead, crack on. Yeah.
I suppose Aberdeen was often in a similar condition.
Yeah, Aberdeen is one of the only two times that I've nearly had to divert. The other time I did have to divert due to weather.
Right, so, okay.
Well, snow anyway.
Well, as I mentioned off air before we started recording, I'm pretty certain I was in the back of one of your flights. So got that very, very tenuous link. And I always have very, very fond memories of flying out of Southampton. It was a great service. And do you know what? The crews were fabulous. There's something special about the crews on those aircraft. I don't know, it's just something unique, and it was a great experience, so I can see why you look at that fondly.
But oh yeah, totally agree.
You then went to follow your father's footsteps. How did the change of career to the 737 come about?
So I always knew I wasn't going to stay on the Q400 forever. As I say, it was an awesome start to the career. I wouldn't have changed that for anything. Hmm. But I wanted, to be frank, a slightly easier life. You know, we were super busy. We were flying 5-6 days a week. And I looked at a lot of my other friends working in perhaps more stable jobs in aviation and doing markedly less, and thought, I feel like I'm missing a trick here. So I moved at a reasonably fortuitous time, actually, to fly the 7-3, because that was sort of what came up. I had a couple of other job offers in the pipeline for various other airlines, but chose my current airline based on sort of attitude, lifestyle, culture, and I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. Tell us then about converting, type conversion, because you're going from a turboprop to a jet. Tell us a little bit about the training. Did your new airline take you through that conversion?
Yeah, they did.
Right.
We did a part generic type rating, and then was topped up by some airline-specific conversion. Do you know, it wasn't as difficult as I was expecting, I think. As I say, having come from the Q400, you had such a great sort of grounding in the stick and rudder side of things that we could all really fly the aircraft. So it was just the procedural side of things.
Right.
I spent a lot of time initially forgetting that an auto throttle existed.
Right.
Still occasionally sort of get a bit twitchy about it.
Yeah.
3 years down the line, because that was just something we'd never had. And there were a few other funny little things, even now, that still come up. I found it quite a lot since the whole COVID thing hit, is that the few times that I have flown, I find some of my first airline SOPs come back more naturally than the current ones.
Yeah.
Which gets a little bit interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating sort of insight into how the human memory works. But no, it wasn't as difficult to convert, I think, as I thought it would be. The big challenge really was the difference culturally between the two airlines.
They're very, very different. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Katie, was just the entry process into particularly your current airline. And whilst we all understand the challenges the world faces at the moment, can you just give us a little bit of advice and guidance and experience of how you got through that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's various stages to any airline assessment. You'll always have something in the way of sort of an interview, however that looks. In aviation, generally, we do what's called competency-based interviews.
Yeah.
So you'll do a little bit of knowledge about the airline, which incidentally for me didn't go all that well.
Okay, tell us about that. Why didn't it go well? What homework didn't you do?
I'd had it in my head in the morning. So we'd done a morning of non-interview stuff, and then they selected however many people they wanted to go through to the interview. And I'd had it in my head that I'd made a mess of the morning.
Right.
So when they said, yeah, you're through to interview, and by the way, you're the first one, my mind went completely blank. So they said, who's the CEO? And I kind of went, do you know what? I have no idea. It was a little bit embarrassing.
Yeah.
Fortunately, made up for it with the rest, the competency-based stuff, which is pretty key to aviation interviews, really. Mm. You know, the kind of, the tell us about a time that you've demonstrated whatever.
Yeah.
Problem solving or dealt with a difficult customer or whatever it happened to be. That's really where the focus is with most airline interviews.
Right.
Okay. Fortunately, I could answer those ones. We'd be having a very different conversation now, I suppose.
Be back on that PA-28 at White Waltham.
Oh, yes.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
One of the things I'm quite intrigued about is the changing culture that you sort of hinted at as well. And although you've joined what is a bigger airline, can you sort of embellish a little bit on why culture is so important to helping you do the job you do?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a very odd job to be, quite honest, in terms of kind of what we're doing. So, you know, you end up locked in a very small room with one other person who you've conceivably never met before for 6, 8, 10 hours of a day. So, of course, there are set expectations of how that person's going to behave in terms of the SOPs. But it's, I can't really explain how strange that can be when you turn up and you're met with a new personality every day. So I think the general personalities between airlines can often vary because certain personality types do tend to gravitate towards certain airlines.
Yeah.
But also in terms of how we deal with the cabin crew. Now, I'm short haul, so we don't have that many cabin crews, 4 or 5. On the Q400, it was only 2. So we were much more of a team within the Q400 because we kind of had to be through necessity.
Yeah.
The briefing styles with the cabin crew at the current airline are very different. And again, were I to move on to long haul with this airline or elsewhere, that would be very different again, because you've suddenly got markedly more cabin crew than we do. So that can make quite a difference. Time pressures are a factor as well. Again, not where I am, but in some other airlines where they're really pushed for time and it's all about on-time performance. That does affect sort of the cultural focus.
Yeah, sure. I want to come back to ask you some questions about CRM and human factors, and that will probably creep into talking about pilots together. But just help us understand a little bit more about the sort of sectors you're flying. What is the 737 model you're flying?
So I fly the 737NG, and I'm currently rated, although we're not currently flying it yet, on the 737 MAX as well.
Right, okay. We'll park the MAX discussion. for a while. Maybe come gently touch on that later. But what sort of sectors are you flying at the moment when, I hate using the term, there's a more normal day, but you know, when you're doing a working day, what's the sort of day in the life of, in terms of some of the sectors you fly, you know, what does it look like?
So for us, because we're a holiday airline, we tend to fly reasonably long flights for a short haul. So it's always a there and back, and lots of Cypruses, Turkeys, even Egypt, Greece. So we're looking at realistically sort of four and a half hours each way. So they're long days. Lots of early morning starts or late nights.
And would you, again, excuse my ignorance in this, but would you, for example, fly out and fly back? Or if it's a longer leg, would you fly out and overnight? Is it traditionally out and back?
Yeah, so we tend to be out and back, right. Certainly on short haul.
Yeah.
Obviously, the long haul guys will go night stop down route. But yeah, we're all out and back.
Right, okay. And what is the NG like to fly? What's it like? I'm sure Ellie might have some questions that will be more taxing than mine. But what's it like in the cabin up front in terms of workload and that sort of thing?
The nice thing for us, I think, about having slightly longer sectors is the workload isn't generally too bad. You know, your first kind of half an hour to an hour after departure is quite busy, and then your last hour is quite busy. And in the middle, there's generally lots of time for a cup of coffee and a bit of a chat and, you know, checking the weather. And you do have some time to yourself to sort of think about what's going on. And that's quite nice. And certainly makes a change from my previous airline where the sectors were so short that you had no time in the cruise at all. But the NG is a nice aircraft to fly. I have it on reasonably good authority from various other friends flying slightly more Gucci bits of kit that it's quite dated. But I think it all depends what you're comparing it to.
Sure.
And having come from the Q400, the 73 is great.
No, it's a lovely aircraft. And for the airline that you work for, I've flown a couple of times. You know, I've noticed they're very clean. I know that's a really weird thing to say, but the aircraft are clean inside and out. And I recognise that most airlines do a reasonable job. I particularly notice that your aircraft do. Is there an ethos around quality in your airline? You know, even though it is predominantly, as you say, potentially taking holiday makers abroad and back, there seems to be a professionalism around the airline that makes it feel a bit different.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. We certainly do pride ourselves on giving all of our passengers the best service that we can. And we certainly, before all of this sort of current situation, we had a lot of incentives, verbal incentives, nothing more, to give that sort of little value added, whether it was having youngsters mostly, but certainly not just youngsters, come up to the flight deck, get their photo taken, you know, wearing one of the pilot's hats in the seat.
Got one of those. not me, brilliant. My daughter, I meant.
Hey, no judgment either way.
I would,
so
honest.
It's all of that stuff. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Do you know, we get it a lot where you get very young children being dragged to the flight deck and do you think you're not interested, it's one of your parents.
Yeah, done that. got that picture as well. But, you know, to be fair, and I'm trying to remember how long the flight was, 2.5, maybe 3 hours. If I've done 2.5, 3 hours, the last thing I want is actually, you know, kids crawling all over me and taking my clothes and wearing them. So, you know, fair cop to the teams in doing that. Because, you know, when I was young, that was the way I got interested in aviation, was going up and seeing the cockpit, understanding, asking some questions and that sort of thing. So I just want to then start to talk about CRM and human factors. Why the interest in this? Because it's something that's, I think, followed you through your career, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. So, I mean, I now have a master's in human factors and aviation, and I'm still toying with the idea of doing a PhD, but we'll see how that goes.
Wow.
Quite a commitment.
Yes, it
is. But fundamentally, you know, aviation over the last 50 years or so, 60 years, has become really safe, hugely safe. You know, we look at the accident rates of even sort of 30 odd years ago, and they're so much higher than they are now. The difference in terms of what's changed really is that the technical side of things, the technological, physical aircraft side, it just doesn't fail, yeah. or very rarely. So the marginal gains in safety in aviation really come from the human elements. They come from human factors. They come from understanding how people react to their environment, whether it's startle in the event of a non-normal, whether it's inputting the correct control response to something that they see and how we can improve that, whether it's something as simple as the ergonomics. And granted, this came from World War II, but, you know, how we design flap levers, gear levers, etc., yeah. so that they are identifiable and so people don't make the mistakes that are inherent, because we're all human. People will always make mistakes. But we want to get to a situation realistically within aviation where the mistakes that are made are not severe.
Right.
So okay. we're never going to reduce. We're never going to eliminate mistakes that people make, because people will always make mistakes, but we need to reduce their impact.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And I suppose that leads on to talk about automation, because automation has progressed over, you know, the last 30 or 40 years to a point where we're now talking about AI and almost the pilotless cockpit and that sort of thing. But there is, of course, that question about flying the aircraft and the ability of the machine, whether it's a computer or some other form of technology, in being able to do that. Given the studies that you do, where's your view on automation and how far it should be pushed?
So I can't conceive of an instance within any of our lifetimes where fully automated aircraft with no pilots in the flight deck will be a thing. I'm personally quite uncomfortable with the idea of reducing it to one, because again, you know, we look at the human element, we look at the subjective judgmental element, and realistically, pilots earn their money, as a general rule, when things go wrong. And considering we've taken out a lot of the mechanical failures, a lot of the stuff that goes wrong is nuanced, is complex, and having the ability to compare the two mental models of the pilots, or more, you know, if you're in a three pilot flight deck or whatever, is hugely valuable. So I can absolutely see automation and, you know, drones or whatever it happens to be increasing in scope in many other ways. But I think in terms of commercial aviation, we will always have a pilot in the flight deck. And I would like to hope, although I'm not totally convinced, that we will always have two.
Yeah. And I've just noticed on social media, I think a few days ago, you were back in the sim. Tell us about A, how you got on, but what is that process? And particularly at the moment where you're not maybe flying as regularly as you would have done, but that hopefully will return, fingers crossed. Tell us about how, you know, the frequency and the role of going into the sim. How does that work?
So actually, I was in the sim for currency, because I was going out of my theoretically 90-day currency. I think they were trying to get it in a bit early. But I've actually been in the sim a couple of times recently for various bits and bobs of routine training. We as an airline are not keeping all of our pilots current purely from a cost perspective. Some other airlines are. Some have done functionally nothing since last year. And the pressure is definitely on when you go to the sim if you've not flown for a while. I mean, the pressure is on when you go to the sim and you flew the day before. So now you find yourself sort of thinking, right, what do these switches do? And it is fascinating the things that you forget and the things you end up saying or not saying. And it's very rarely anything major. But certainly the one that I found most fascinating is my muscle memory is quite strong. So I find my hand gravitating towards an overhead panel. But my brain can't comprehend what I want to do with that overhead panel. You have to physically engage your brain and go, right, what is this, please? What do I need to do? Which is where the challenge lies, because, of course, that means that everything goes a little bit slower and it doesn't flow in a nice, slick way that it normally would.
Right.
So it's always a challenge. No sim is without jeopardy. But actually, you know what? Last week's sim was really nice to get back just to doing something.
And Katie, do you the way you explained that then with the muscle memory versus the brain, do you think that way predominantly because you've got a greater interest in human factors? Do you analyse that maybe a little bit more than anyone else?
I suspect so, to be fair, because it is a particular interest, and I do often spend time wondering, you know, why we do what we do, why we make the decisions that we make on the flight deck sometimes.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so the big question is, and we're assuming, you know, that the world, Boris, does get us a bit more open very, very soon, and you're flying more regularly. Where do you want to go next in terms of aircraft and that sort of thing? Because your airline has the ability for you to move into different aircraft types and long haul potentially. Where's the ambition?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely fancy long haul. I think that would be, I don't know if I'd want to do it forever, but it's certainly something that I feel like I should sort of tick off.
Yeah.
You know, it's a totally different lifestyle. And again, I look at my friends that do long haul and they do have a completely different lifestyle. And when we're both busy, while they're working hard in different hours, they at least get some time off sort of down route and get to see something slightly more different than Birmingham Airport.
Yeah.
So nothing I fancy giving Birmingham. It a go. There is nothing wrong
no,
with
No, it's a delight. It's a delightful place, Birmingham Airport.
I'd still quite like to see something slightly more exotic every now and then.
Yeah. And if you did, transest to what other aircraft would be open to you in terms of the fleet at the moment?
So if I was currently going to go long haul with the current airline, I'd be on the 787.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
It is quite pretty.
Now, did I not see, Katie, you, maybe I missed something on one of your social media posts. Did I not see you fly in long haul on something? Or was that just something? Maybe I just picked up you're flying to the sun more often than the likes of me.
So we did a detachment, what was it, in winter 2019, out to Canada, working on behalf of a Canadian airline.
Right, I thought I'd seen something. And it was the 737, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Right. We were flying down to the Caribbean.
I can't show my ignorance because that aircraft is not flying from Birmingham to Georgetown.
No, it's not.
Oh, that must have been interesting. Tell us about that.
It was really different. Lots of challenges that you don't get in Europe, and I suspect a lot of that is because, you know, we're so familiar with Europe. But I think the other thing that really struck me about sort of going down to the Caribbean, aside from the fact that the islands are in many ways sort of often less economically developed than a lot of the places that we go to in Europe, was just how big America is. So just how big the US is. Flying from Ottawa across the US and then pretty much just hopping over the edge of the US border and, you know, landing in Cuba or wherever it happened to be. The US is huge.
Yeah, it is.
And I hadn't quite comprehended that in the same way until I had to fly down the length of it on a regular basis.
Yeah. And what sort of duration were those flights? They must have been a good 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, the longest one we did was 7 hours down to Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, which was a killer. I mean, that is a long haul flight.
Yeah.
On a short haul aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. There's not a great deal of space to stretch out. I thought I'd seen something on your social media feeds, but I daren't ask the question because I thought there's no 737s for that airline in the Caribbean, but I was right. And a quick plug for your social media feed, and we'll get it later, but well worth following for all the stories and the great things you're doing. So highly recommend it to listeners, and we'll give the details of that later.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation-minded country. and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows, and there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Katie, during this career and the career to date, you've also had another role and you've supported youngsters coming through. Tell us about your role with the RAF Air Cadets, Royal Air Force Air Cadets.
Sure. So I've been with the Air Cadets now for 12 years. Never a cadet, but joined as an adult. And it was one of those where sort of one of my friends happened to mention one day, and he too is a pilot, that we could do with a bit of support for this one particular evening. Went down for that one particular evening and have never been able to leave.
Okay.
It sucks you in. But it's been a great organisation, and I've done all sorts of stuff over the 12 years so far, from commanding a couple of squadrons of my own to being a region STEM officer. So we're split into six regions. The organisation's got somewhere in the region of 40,000 cadets, so we're not a small organisation by any stretch. And I'm now the aerospace officer for a different region.
Okay. I don't understand. What does that mean? I don't understand. I used to be a sea cadet many years ago, but I don't understand the structure of the air cadets. What's that role entail?
So my role as the aerospace officer for London and South East region is to effectively facilitate anything aerospacey. So whether that is making sure that the flying and gliding slots that we get from the RAF and the Air Cadets Volunteer Gliding Squadrons, that they get filled. So we get cadets up flying, because of course, for a lot of them, that's really what they're joined for. Mm. Offering some experiential stuff, whether that's visits, whether that's talks. We've had a series of brilliant virtual talks over the last year or so, which has just been superb. We're now looking at how we expand to offer maybe some drone training as well, because of course, the unmanned aerial side of things is a big deal within the Air Force.
So
lots of kind of aerospace related experiential qualification opportunities for the young people, really.
Okay, and you've got a you've got quite an impressive uniform, I think, the last time I saw you dressed up. What's your position? Where do you sit in the structure of things?
None of us are obviously regular Air Force. We're not even real Air Force. We were once Volunteer Reserve Training Branch, and we're now Cadet Forces Commission. So effectively, we hold a commission which is not real. We can't get deployed.
Right.
There's people from around the country with a huge range of different skills, but many of them would not particularly help in a combat situation, myself included. So I'm currently a squadron leader, which is a purely rank thing. There's a lot of us around the organisation. I wouldn't even want to hesitate a number, many.
right.
But senior enough that I've sort of proven that I've got some benefit, if you like.
Hmm.
And I'm certainly doing my best to contribute what I can.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about some of the youngsters that you work with. What's their attitude to the sector? Is there an excitement? Is there a passion? How are they feeling about the future of careers in the aviation, aerospace, military sector?
So they're a really keen bunch overall. Mm. Obviously, with 40,000 cadets, you get a huge range of attitudes. But as a general rule, they're really enthusiastic, passionate a lot. They want to give up their evenings to learn about principles of flight. aerospace battle management, whatever it happens to be, the aviation side of things, both civilian and military, is really what excites them.
Hmm.
Now, we offer lots of other activities as well, but actually the aerospace stuff is what they've joined for. You know, they could have joined the Sea Cadets, they could have joined the Army Cadets, but they've chosen to join the Air Cadets. Now, in terms of the RAF and sort of future careers within the RAF, when we look at things like Astra and the RAF sort of initiatives for the future, it looks quite optimistic. The cadets that want to go into the civvy side of things, there aren't a huge number every year, just sort of based on the demographics that we end up with. But I think they're sort of cautiously optimistic of the fact that things will recover. It's not going to be this year, but things will recover. And they've set themselves in hugely good stead by having this background within the Air Cadets and all of the qualifications and experiential side of things that they've done there.
Mm.
That they've got something a little bit different and quite valuable to give as well.
What do you get out of it, Katie?
I mean, of course, there's the satisfaction of watching some of the youngsters genuinely change and blossom. But of course, it's more than that. You know, the social side as an adult is great.
Hmm.
I've done a load of things that I'd never have done if I hadn't joined the Air Cadets. You know, from camps in Gibraltar to climbing various mountains that I'd never have done, to learning to shoot, to, you know, the list is pretty much endless. So it really does offer opportunities for adult staff as well.
Okay.
Just got to take them.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. And we've hinted a few times about the role that you're supporting at the moment. But I'd like to talk about Pilots Together now, mm-hmm. and the support you bring to that organisation. To be honest, up until quite recently, I didn't know too much about Pilots Together. Can you just tell us about its role, its mission, its objectives?
Yeah, of course. So we're a really new charity, actually. We were only set up at the very end of last year, I want to say September, to support redundant pilots who have been made redundant due to COVID-19, because we effectively identified that there was a gap in the market and nobody was really offering those individuals any tangible support. And, you know, the number of pilots that have been made redundant, even just looking at the UK, let alone across the world, is absolutely staggering. So that's kind of how the charity came about, really. Now, the majority of the guys that set it up were from one airline. I am the token external, which is lovely, to add a slightly different approach. But yeah, we've come together really quickly to offer something that people needed.
Hmm. Now, I've grown up. I'm older than both of you, probably put together actually. but I've grown up thinking of pilots in a particular way. You know, when I was young, a pilot was a bit of a superhero, not because of my interest in aviation or anything like that, but their stature within society, within our cultures, and that sort of thing was very high. Given what we're going through now, help me, I suppose, dispel that myth and tell me a bit about what Pilots Together is doing, particularly in the wellbeing agenda, to help some of those people through.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think there is still the last vestiges of a slightly macho culture within the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it is across the industry, regardless of whether or not people have made redundant, it's still a challenge to get people to speak up about mental health, because there's this perception that people will be ostracized, that they'll lose their license, they'll lose their medical, and that's the end of their career, which simply isn't true. You know, the CAA are very supportive of getting people back into work. But we're having to overcome a massive cultural issue here. So where you're coming from, like, that all fed into that sort of macho culture, that sort of superhero status, if you like. In terms of Pilots Together, then, one of the things that we are doing is looking at how we support people emotionally and from a wellbeing perspective rather than just financially, So while we have the financial side to it, because of course there are people who are in really dire financial straits. I mean, it has been incredibly humbling to listen to some of these people's stories. The majority of our redundant pilots, they can pay their bills, they can get by. It's not comfortable, but in that sense, you know, they're in a very similar position to a lot of us, I think, at the moment. That it's not, life is not as comfortable as it was. But the difference for them is they don't have that flying career, that vocation, realistically, to go back to. And we've certainly identified that these pilots are finding it really hard to see that light at the end of the tunnel. And one of the big things that's come out of the conversations that we've had with them is they really value knowing that somebody's there. They really value knowing that the aviation community still considers them part of it, that they haven't achieved this sort of sense of otherness by being made redundant. They are still pilots. They're just pilots who aren't flying. Because, I mean, it really is a vocation. You can't go into aviation without loving it. You've got so many hoops to jump through that the people that do it really love what they do. And they've effectively had that sense of identity ripped away from them because of the redundancies. You know, we look back to previous, maybe airlines that have been made redundant, but also even financial crises and stuff. That only really affected the UK. So there was always scope for those individuals, and many of them did, to go elsewhere, to go and fly in, you know, whether it's the Middle East or wherever it happened to be. Right now, the world is in a very different state. So it's difficult for any of our redundant pilots to really be able to identify when they'll next be able to fly. And that loss of identity has been huge. So we are providing a lot of talking, mostly, and offering sort of community events. You know, we'd like to do pub nights, but obviously there's a few legal challenges to that at the moment.
Not long.
So one of the things that's meant to be launching in, I think 2 weeks now, is some sort of virtual drop-in sessions for the redundant pilots to come and just talk aviation with people, to talk about pertinent issues in aviation, you know, whether that's RNAV approaches or whatever it happens to be on that particular evening, and just feel like they're still part of that community.
And I don't know how to describe it other than the sort of elephant in the room, but whilst we come out of 2020, we're in 2021, and whilst there's light at the end of the country's tunnel in terms of opening up, the aviation and in particular the airline industry is going to continue to suffer for some time, probably, and therefore some of those individuals you mentioned. One of the biggest issues that many of those younger, air quotes going on here, in experience terms, not necessarily age, is the debt that they've incurred in actually getting to the front, the pointy end of the aeroplane. How's the industry responding to that? Is there any give, you know, because those debts are quite considerable, particularly for, you talked about some of those airlines where the pressure is maybe a bit greater. Some of the pilots that we know and we've talked to have spent significant and very significant amounts of money to get to that point, only to have that rug pulled away. What sort of support is out there for those individuals, if any?
So this is where it gets quite difficult, really, is that fundamentally there isn't a huge amount, because the industry really is on its knees. You know, we've all taken hefty pay cuts. That's not true. The overwhelming majority of us have suffered financially, massively so, as a result of the last year or so. And as you say, we will continue to do so. So as an industry, there's not a huge amount that we can do, certainly for those individuals who are just coming out of flight school now and are starting to have to repay those debts. Because functionally, their debt is with the banks. But it does highlight a bigger issue, I think. It highlights an issue of the fact that fundamentally we're expecting people to pay a disproportionate sum, which is excluding an awful lot of people from the industry in order to do a job. I can't think of any other industries where that's the case, where you really have to fork out anything like as much as you do to become an airline pilot.
Now
there are some changes afoot. There is I can't remember the name offhand, but there are a couple of schools that are offering effectively a modular route at a very reasonable price, because of course flying isn't cheap. But it's not the price that a lot of these places are charging. So will that help the people that are currently struggling because they're trying to repay their debts? Not so much. But hopefully it will at least mean that accessibility to the industry when things do recover is a lot better.
Yeah. And one of the ironic things that I suppose occurred during certainly 2020 in the early part was that to get the PPE, to get, you know, as we've seen recently, the vaccine moving both nationally and internationally, it's done by aeroplane. And so those individuals that have suffered the most are then called on to do probably the most critical thing to get the country and regions going again. It's really ironic that pilots will be called upon to help this country get back on its feet, you know, just within this week since we've seen the announcement. I don't know whether it was 48 hours ago, I think I saw one booking site say it had seen a 600% increase in holiday bookings. I don't quite know how that's going to occur because there's nothing flying at the moment, and it just doesn't go from zero to not 100, 150, 200% in terms of thing. How do you see that sort of unfolding for the sector?
So it's a really interesting one, and it's one that I'm involved in some of the discussions within our airline about how we're going to get that working. Fundamentally, if the goalposts stay where they are, I think it's feasible. A lot of the places that we fly to, a lot of the holiday destinations, they do need the income from tourism. So some way those will open up. One of the big challenges we're certainly facing is the training burden and how we get everybody back current. Because no airline can keep everyone current like this. It costs a huge amount of money to do so. So generally, as I said before, you know, they've let a lot of people lapse, and getting everyone back to currency is a massive training burden. So we are working on a reduced figure of what we expect to fly in the summer, as a kind of conservative estimate, I think. And I think a lot of other airlines are doing something broadly similar.
Yeah.
They're trying to offer what they think they can realistically fulfill, given all of the restrictions that we've got, and sort of going from there. But, you know, fingers crossed, the winter and next summer will be, bookings will be through the roof, because people do want to go away. As you say, the demand is clearly there.
Yeah.
It's just that concern of, you know, what happens if my flight gets cancelled? What happens if the government changes the goalposts?
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
What can our listeners do to support Pilots Together? What opportunity do we have to support the work you're doing, either in simple form or in any other form?
So there's tons that you know, we'd really value support with. We had a raffle at the tail end of last year, which was hugely successful. We are looking at doing another one. Date to be confirmed on that one. But I would certainly advise anyone to buy raffle tickets because the prizes are awesome.
What sort of things were in the last one, Katie?
So the last one included some simulator time in I think some of the BA simulators. There was an opportunity to do a wine tasting with the Israeli wine expert. We had lots of aviation prints. We had a signed Concorde chart. There was all manner of stuff. I can't really talk about what we've got for the next one, but I've got some of it in my wardrobe at the moment. And there's some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit envious of whoever wins some of it.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll help you promote that when we can.
Brill. Yeah, no, there's that. And I mean, if your listeners have a look on the website, Pilots Together is pretty easy to find. I can't remember the exact
pilotstogether.org. Sure,
yeah. Wonderful. Glad somebody knows. You know, we're always interested in people who have got job opportunities going and they recognize the value that a pilot can bring to that. There's the opportunity to donate as a sort of a one-off as well, of course, from a financial perspective, but it's certainly not all about money. If people have contacts, if they do realize that, you know, pilots bring such a varied and valuable skill set to the workplace, then that's absolutely the sort of thing that a lot of our redundant pilots are looking for as well.
And I suppose just thinking that through, is there the opportunity then for you to, I don't know how else to describe this other than have some sort of job bank type approach, or is it through introductions you're particularly looking to do that? How would that work, Katie, for any pilots who are out there potentially who don't know about the work you're doing? How can they get involved, either in supporting you, but also for potentially some of those pilots who may be isolated and suffering themselves?
So if they go onto the website, pilots can register as a redundant pilot. So I think it's, I need help or I can give help, with kind of your options that you've got there. And that allows you access to the forum. It allows you access to effectively a jobs board of what's available. And, you know, as things go on and we do manage to get some sort of face-to-face events, that will give people access to that as well. But of course, if people aren't redundant, because we are only supporting the redundant pilots in that sense at the moment, then just signing up to the newsletter will sort of give people a bit of a heads up on what we're doing and what's going on.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Ellie, I'm going to just come to you before I wrap up with Katie. Was there anything I missed or you wanted to add in?
Yeah, sure. So I fly doing quite a lot of kind of formation flying and stuff. And I know with all those pilots, we get quite a bit of banter. So have you ever played a cruel trick on a crew member or an airline?
Oh, there's an interesting question. Do you know, I don't think I've ever played a cruel trick on people. We're generally quite nice. I think one of the issues that you have with sort of the airline side of things is because we don't fly with the same people very often, if at all, you kind of have to be on your best behaviour. That said, we do occasionally play pranks on some of the cabin crew, which can be quite good fun. Less so in the current airline, certainly on the dash we used to mess around a little bit. But it's having that kind of that balance of you know, being professional and also having a good time potentially with people that you've never met can be a slightly tricky balancing act.
And Katie, just one of the questions I suppose that brings up, what's the best place you've flown to? Where do you enjoy flying to? You know, taking the experience out of the journey, are there any particular destinations that are more appealing than others?
Yeah, so I like anywhere that's a bit challenging, to be honest. Although right now I'd go anywhere.
Like, yeah, just of course,
being in the air would be lovely.
Yeah.
So we fly to Funchal, which is always quite good fun.
That's a challenge.
You know, you've got a massive mountain.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
That's where the crosswinds are a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, the crosswinds are a challenge, visibility is a challenge, and the massive mountain that they've built the runway on is a bit of a challenge as well.
Right, okay.
But that's always good fun. And do you know what? I love Jamaica as well, going into Montego Bay last winter, just because it's so picturesque. And every time I went down there, it was stunningly beautiful.
Yeah. How cool does that sound, flying into Montego Bay?
I know.
Wonderful, wonderful. Ellie, anything else before we ask Katie to tell us where we can find out about her online?
Yeah, so given that you just said you love landing in challenging places, what is the most challenging landing situation you've ever had?
Do you know, the most challenging landing situation I've ever had was in one of the most boring places to fly into, weirdly. So when we used to fly a lot into Amsterdam and came in one day and it was horrific, like properly horrific. It was windy, it was rainy, there was a thunderstorm sitting near the airfield. But of course, this hadn't really been forecast. And we had to get on the ground, and as did everybody else. So that was one of those approaches, and it was in the Q400, so no auto throttle, working quite hard, where I was exhausted by the time I got on the ground, because it was just, you were fighting the aircraft, you were fighting the weather, but also trying to keep it as smooth as possible for the passengers. Because invariably, the only days that you have passengers who are scared of flying are the days when the weather's horrible. So yeah, that was a bit of a challenge. I've had a few tech issues as well, but that was probably the one that sticks into my mind most.
Awesome, that does sound pretty cool.
Yeah, it does. Any interest, Ellie, in having a crack at those two aircraft, the Q400 or the 737? Have you been in a simulator? You have, haven't you?
Yeah, so I was in the A320 simulator, which was really, really fun. Completely different to any aircraft that I've flown, but it's still, what I found fascinating was it still flew like a normal aircraft, which is awesome. So yeah, any aircraft, I'm willing to go look at.
And we talked, this question for you both actually, we talked in our last episode to a military helicopter pilot, and one of the questions Tim asked was about the difference between flying a flight sim and flying an aircraft, and what he said was the flight sims are great for process, but when you're flying, you get that extra sensory, I don't know, it's like your muscle feel, where you just know what the aircraft's going to do. You feel, you have a feel for it. And even in AI, because that was where the discussion went, even using AI, yes, it felt realistic, but not, you just couldn't get that flying feeling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was only discussing this with somebody yesterday that I can't, well, I say I can, but I can't land the simulator very well because it's all based on numbers and you don't get that feel. So if they've given you a hefty crosswind, you can't feel the aircraft down onto the ground. And it is, it's all about having that kind of feedback and that, as you say, that sense of where you are and what's going on. And flight sims are hard. Like they're harder than the real thing.
Oh, don't tell Tim that. he'd think he can do what Ellie's doing. Ellie, you're doing your aerobatic qualification, or you're starting on that journey. Have you done any aerobatics, Katie?
Not a huge amount, to be honest. We did a little bit spinning wise as part of the flight instructor's rating. And I've gone up and done some aeros with the air experienced flight guys with the air cadets. But that's about it, really.
Okay. Well, we're all behind you, Ellie, on that one. It's not something I could do. Well, maybe you can take me up when you're qualified. I don't know. Not for me. So on that note, Katie, tell us where we can find you online.
So my usual social media platform is Twitter. At Catherine A. Lee. Occasionally venture into Instagram, but mostly forget about it. So most of my flying anecdotes and pictures are on Twitter.
Okay. And I, as I mentioned earlier, you're quite active, particularly at the moment for obvious reasons, but it's all good stuff. I noticed you've been having some food competitions, which were quite interesting, and some cooking competitions. How did that come about?
Do you know what? I have no idea. It was one of those that I think was in a discussion after a glass of wine or two with a few friends. And we just realised, like, the aviation industry on Twitter, the aviation community was a little bit bored and needed something to pep it up.
Yeah.
So, the Bake Off has been good fun. We've got the final on Saturday, which will be interesting, actually. I've yet to receive any photographs from any of the contestants. But it's been good. It's been a nice little distraction.
Yeah,
for fascinating. The last sort of 5 weeks.
Fascinating. Well done. Okay, well, on that note, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Katie. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show and to Amy for communication support on this episode. We'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters. That's Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, Ellie, where can we find you online?
So I'm on Twitter at DragonGirl94, Instagram EllieCarter74, and Facebook is just Ellie Carter.
And you're pretty active at the moment as well, so I'd like to make sure that everyone's following you, particularly on Twitter. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course Aviation Extended on Twitter and our Facebook pages. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Ellie Carter.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Katie Lee.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a stall being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.